Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world. Online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I'm going to read some headlines. You tell me what the real story is, all right? MasterCard raised its profit forecast today. Costco profits are up. Sears going the other way. If you need a hint, throw in what you already know about food and energy prices, and then stick around. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Grant Thornton, serving their audit, tax, and advisory clients worldwide with people who love what they do. Online at grantthornton.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is good to have you with us today. It's Thursday, the 29th of May. And just to review, we've got MasterCard saying it's going to be earning more money than it thought it would. And Costco telling us its profits rose 32%. Throw in the fact that Big Lots, the country's biggest closeout retailer, saw profits jump 20%. And what do you get? Well, you get this story from our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Today's numbers are a clear indicator of how the soaring costs of essentials like gasoline, food, and housing have rapidly escalated from a cause for worry to an outright shift in consumer behavior.
Clearly, it looks like the consumer continues to trade down to more value-oriented retailers here.
Ken Perkins heads the marketing research firm Retail Metrics. He says it's no mystery why the big warehouse chains are all doing good business in the face of the slumping economy.
Part of the attraction for a BJ's or a Costco or a Sam's Club is the fact that it can be a one-stop shop. You can buy your gasoline there, you can get your groceries there, you can get apparel, other home necessities there at a relatively decent price and in bulk if you need it.
Likewise, the appeal of Walmart, Big Lots, and other discounters is obvious. Consumer behavior analyst Britt Beamer says saving money has become the top priority. More of us are clipping coupons and scrimping in all kinds of ways.
Consumers are migrating to almost what I consider to be a bare-bones strategy. You now have, for example, 67% of consumers who are negotiating lower prices in stores when they can, double from the normal 33% of a few years ago. 59% of consumers out there making lists prior to shopping in stores so they can stay focused to buy what they need to buy. So consumers are going to do what they can to be able to pay their bills.
Does that mean it's the end of the world for Sears and other department store and specialty chains? Beamer says not necessarily, as long as they can figure out how to give customers what they want, lower prices, and big discounts. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Picking up where Bob left off, there is an irony here that might not be fully appreciated. While debt helped the economy and us get into this mess in the first place, think credit crunch, many of us are looking at debt as a way to get through it. Americans are maxing out our plastic. And as Ashley Milne-Tite reports, credit card companies are only too happy to let us do it.
MasterCard raised its profit forecast today, saying consumers are using more plastic. Robert Manning directs the Center for Consumer Financial Services at the Rochester Institute of Technology. He says when MasterCard and Visa were owned by the banks, customer balances generated much of their profits. Now they're independent, their revenue comes mostly from the number of card swipes.
Under this structure, there's a lot of revenue now that they're seeing for people that would have used cash that they're more aggressively marketing debit cards, too.
They're selling credit cards hard as well. And Scott Hoyt of MoodysEconomy.com says consumers are buying. He says until recently, many people were borrowing against the value of their homes.
Now, since house prices are declining, consumers are much less able to borrow against what equity they have in their homes, and as a result, are shifting the borrowing that they're doing back towards credit cards.
Hoyt says spending is down and will continue to fall. He's not convinced the increased use of cards will hurt the economy. But Robert Manning isn't so sure. He says a wave of middle-class loan holders are struggling to pay their mortgages, and they're tapping whatever credit lines they can.
assuming and being convinced that the housing market is going to recover and it's okay to take on all this credit card debt.
He says it's a dangerous gamble. If the market continues to melt down, they could lose their homes and find themselves buried under a mountain of debt. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
I don't know about you, but it sort of feels to me like the big picture economy stories today need a punctuation mark of sorts. So here it is. The economy's growing just a pinch faster than we thought it was a month ago. First quarter gross domestic product was revised upward this morning from 0.6 to 0.9%. There was an international conference on Iraq today. At the meeting in Stockholm, Sweden, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki asked his Arab neighbors for a little bit of relief. He wants more than $60 billion in debt forgiveness. For the most part, the answer was a polite no, but Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports there was one country willing to help.
Most of Iraq's debts to its Persian Gulf neighbors date back to the 1980s, when the Sunni-dominated government of Saddam Hussein was willing to take on the Shiite mullahs in Iran. Wright State University professor Riad Ajami says the Sunnis in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia were happy to lend Hussein money to fight Iran.
He said, "I'm fighting on your behalf. I have the army. I need the resources. You put up the money." And they forked out the money.
Now, the new leader of Iraq, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, says those loan payments are a drag on development. To benefit the entire region's economy, he's asking for debt relief. But Maliki's government is now run by a Shiite majority, and the Sunni regimes in the Persian Gulf are reluctant to forgive old debts, especially given the one country now offering financial aid.
The Iranians are willing to help, and the Iranians do have the resources.
Iran has already loaned Iraq $1 billion with easy repayments over 40 years.
And for that reason, the Sunni Arabs would want to help the Iraqis, but they would want better behavior and better promises from the Shia-dominated government in Iraq.
Professor Ajami says before Sunni Arabs invest in Iraq's debt, they want promises that Iraq's new government won't get too close to Iran. That's why Saudi Arabia and Kuwait sent only low-level bureaucrats to listen to today's plea from Iraq's prime minister. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
If you needed it, here's today's evidence there's not much rational thought going into oil prices anymore. The Energy Department said this morning U.S. crude inventories fell last week unexpectedly. So what happened on the trading floor at the NYMEX? Yeah, crude lost almost $4.50 to close at $126.62 a barrel. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's going to be a couple of weeks yet before we see the newest version of the iPhone. Apple aficionados are waiting with bated breath, I'm sure. But for more people who are concerned with what's cool on the inside than how something looks, the Apple brand's a little less cool than it used to be. Commentator Jonathan Zittrain explains.
In 1977, a 21-year-old Steve Jobs unveiled the Apple II PC. For the first time in a convenient single plastic molded case, there was a device that you could take home to give you a blinking cursor. But you could write programs to make it do whatever you wanted and run programs written by others. After two guys unrelated to Apple invented VisiCalc, the first spreadsheet, sales of Apple skyrocketed, and Apple didn't even know why. In 1984, Jobs gave us the Mac, the first PC that didn't act like a build-your-own Heathkit. Gone was the blinking cursor. Turn on the Mac, and it smiled at you. But it still ran code from anywhere. It could still surprise us. Now fast forward to 2007. Jobs puts forward the iPhone. It's gorgeous. It's versatile. It's intuitive. It's more Mac than a Mac. But it will not run just any outside code. Outsiders can't send the next VisiCalc to iPhone owners directly. Instead, proposed new software has to go through the centralized iPhone App Store. Apple takes a cut of each piece of software sold and reserves the right to kill any app it doesn't like. Limits so far? Piracy, porn, bandwidth hog, and unforeseen. No more surprises. As goes the iPhone, so goes the world. Nerds of today are coding for cool but tethered gizmos like the iPhone and Web 2.0 platforms like Facebook and Google Apps. All of these platforms are attractive, but they naturally keep control in the hands of the platform maker in a way that the famously proprietary Bill Gates never achieved with Windows. You might think that's not so bad, but there's something precious about that plastic molded case, the blinking cursor that says anything is not only possible, but likely. Thanks to our own tastes, similar to those that prefer Walmart to the local general store, The Wild West IT landscape is, sadly, going suburban for most of us. That's a future I hope we can still avoid.
Jonathan Zittrain is the co-founder of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. His new book is called The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It. Before he does, you can use the web to send us your thoughts. Go to our homepage. It's marketplace.org. Just click on that link that says contact. World Bank President Robert Zoellick said today the bank's going to be adding more than $1 billion to its food and agriculture programs. That news dovetails nicely with a report out of the United Nations and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development this morning. They say high food prices are going to be with us for a good long while, and as is often the case, the pain is not going to be spread evenly. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has more.
High food prices create incentives for farmers to plant more crops and increase production. Dan Gustafson is with the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, which commissioned the study. He says food prices had been in a slump for decades. That kept countries from investing in higher-yield methods of farming.
Now with unrest in cities and demand from urban population for cheaper food and so on, I think that the political equation for investing in agriculture looks a lot clearer than it did, let's say, a few years ago.
Most of the increase in production is expected to come from developing countries. But Julie Howard, with the Partnership to Cut Poverty and Hunger in Africa, says not everyone benefits equally.
Without a doubt, higher prices will spur increased investment in agriculture in Africa. And that is a good thing. But, you know, what we have to think about is you can't just turn a switch and get more production overnight.
In the short term, she says the poor need relief, but they need investment for the long term. Howard says the current U.S. pledge of $150 million for ag development in Africa is a 10-year low.
That's just, I think, a drop in the bucket of what's needed and doesn't even get us back to where we were 4, 5, 10 years ago in terms of our investment in African agriculture.
The UN's Food and Agriculture Organization says $1.7 billion is needed to help poor countries pay for seeds, fertilizers, and other materials for farming. The UN will press its case next week at a conference on world food security in Rome. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
John McCain said last night he's going to skip a big Senate vote next week on climate change. No word yet from the Obama and Clinton camps whether they'll show up to weigh in on the Lieberman-Warner Climate Security Act. If it does pass, it'd cut U.S. greenhouse gas emissions nearly 70% by 2050, and it would do it by putting a price on carbon. Most lawmakers do favor cutting CO2 emissions. The debate, though, is how to get that done fairly once carbon's not free anymore. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
In a carbon-constrained economy like the one proposed under the Lieberman-Warner bill, Eric Williamson would be deeply affected. The 36 employees at his Southern California aluminum foundry handcraft everything from skateboard axles to electric motor casings.
And so you're basically constantly spending money on energy, whether it's air, electricity, welders, ovens, furnaces. That's all we do. That's all we do.
A cap on greenhouse gas emissions would trickle down to businesses like Williamson's in the form of higher energy bills and shipping costs. Despite that, Williamson still supports Lieberman-Warner.
If it is beneficial to planet Earth and it's beneficial to human beings, I cannot oppose it. You know what I mean? I have kids. I have family. It's like I want this world to do well.
But if that same legislation doesn't help companies like his adapt to the new low-carbon economy, Williamson says he'd have no choice but to close up shop. This is a major dilemma facing senators as they begin to debate the climate bill. Steve Cochran is with the Environmental Defense Fund.
This is a transition that we're talking about, and what government policy will be attempting to focus on is how to manage that transition, how to ease that so that that costs don't fall disproportionately on companies.
Basically, it boils down to a question of fairness. The Lieberman-Warner bill would place a limit or cap on all greenhouse gas emissions beginning 5 years from now. Over several decades, that cap would gradually increase, giving polluters a simple choice: clean up or pay for every ton of CO2 they emit beyond their government-issued quota. In order to ease big emitters into the new system, Congress would give some industries their emissions quotas, otherwise known as allowances, for free in the beginning. But not everyone's happy.
This bill, just on its face, chooses winners and losers. I mean, it's very obvious.
Lou Hayden is with the American Petroleum Institute, the main trade group for big oil.
Some emitters get some allowances in year one to soften the economic burden on them. However, we found that how these are distributed seems to be a political decision.
Hayden says oil companies have gotten the short end of the stick in the allocation of free allowances. That means they'll be forced to pay for most of their greenhouse gas emissions from the outset. But Environmental Defense's Steve Cochran says that's the point of not giving too many allowances away for free.
They become the commodity, they become the currency by which the value of these reductions is measured and by which we can manage and monitor and evaluate and ultimately succeed in changing our energy economy.
Federal sales of emissions allowances are expected to generate nearly $6 trillion in revenue by mid-century. That's money the government can use to help both consumers and industry ease the transition to a low-carbon world. Think tax relief for individuals and hundreds of billions of dollars in incentives for industrial efficiency projects. But Cochran says with a bill that touches nearly every corner of the American economy, it's impossible to please everyone.
More money to help consumers could mean less money to help business.
Cochran says inequities like these may be a political reality, but they pale in comparison to the cost of business as usual. A study out this week by Tufts University predicts the U.S. economy would suffer a $4 trillion annual hit by the end of the century if nothing is done to curb global warming. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Sam took his camera with him out to that aluminum foundry. You can see what he saw on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, bummed out by books when the royalties don't roll in.
Because I was so excited at the beginning of the contract. I went to bed. It was hard for me to sleep. I was thinking I was going to be rich the next day.
But first, let's do the numbers. That surprising GDP growth and a dip in oil prices spurred a modest rally today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials moved up 0.4%, 52 points to close at 12,646. The Nasdaq gained 0.8%, 21 points to close at 2508. The S&P 500 rose 0.5%. That is 7 points, ended the day at 1398. We told you about Big Lots' oversized quarterly earnings. As a result, the retailer boxed up a 7.5% increase today. MasterCard charged ahead almost 8%. Visa ran up a gain of 4%. Countrywide Financial soared 8.25% today. The mortgage lender said it will hold a special meeting on June 25th to approve its sale to Bank of America. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.08%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Areva, solutions for producing CO2-free energy and transmitting and distributing electricity. Online at us.areva.com. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for April. Kids compete at the Scripps Howard National Spelling Bee Finals. A lot of homework to prepare for that. And if you don't want to do your homework, how about some cartoons? The voice of Bugs Bunny, Foghorn Leghorn, and Daffy Duck, the late Mel Blanc, was born on May 30th, 1908. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. IndyCar racing goes to Milwaukee this weekend for a race called the Milwaukee Mile. If you're thinking right about now, wasn't the Indy 500 last weekend? Yes, it was. The Indy Racing League's about more than just Indianapolis, though, and after a decade-long internal feud, the IRL is trying to steer itself straight ahead. Diana Nyad's here to talk racing with us. Hey, Diana.
Diana Nyad's here to tell us about it. Hey, Diana.
Kai, what's going on?
Not so much. IndyCars, though, this past weekend. I watched. Did you watch?
I watched, yeah. As a matter of fact, the very first job I ever had in sports broadcasting was with ABC's Wide World of Sports.
Yeah.
They said to me, we're going to send you to the most exciting moment in all of sports, the Indy 500. You won't work it. We just want you to meet all the announcers.
That's cool.
Have a good time.
Yeah.
And I tell you, in the 1970s and up through the 1980s, that was a big crowd, and it was one of the most exciting moments in all of sports. It's come down from there.
Well, and that's actually a little bit sad, though, really, because it's such a marquee event.
It is, but I guess, you know, if we could look at boxing, we could look at horse racing. I mean, you know, how many sports can stay there, you know, all that time?
But IndyCar has had its troubles. They had a feud. They're back together now. Still sort of not doing really well.
Well, you know, you could say that 250,000 people, which is about, you know, who showed up, you know, at Indianapolis last Sunday, is a pretty good crowd. It's the largest crowd at any single sporting event in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't think too many other sports or events would cry about that.
What does it say about this sport, though, about the future of it, when it can really be summed up in one word, Danica, or two words maybe, Danica Patrick, and some of the biggest names in it are names from the past. You've got former winner Bobby Rahal's son, Graham. You've got Marco Andretti, grandson of Mario Andretti. I mean, that can't be any kind of a basis for the future.
Well, first of all, let's forget Danica for a minute, because she is IRL
racing right now.
She's the queen. If she's racing, you're going to watch, and they're going to get big numbers. But for the rest of the juniors, and we go down to A.J. Foyt, the fourth
right.
Actually. I don't think that's a negative thing. There are plenty of people my age who, that's one of the reasons we tune in. We say, oh, that's cool, all these sons and grandsons, and pretty soon it's going to be great-grandsons are racing. You know, what a tradition, just like the Petty brothers were in NASCAR. It keeps generations around. It keeps the father and the son and the daughter going out again.
Well, an excellent segue, as a matter of fact. NASCAR, when you think racing in this country, not too many people probably think IndyCar racing. They all think NASCAR because it's the most popular thing going.
It is. And one of the things it has going for it is that it's all American good old boys all the time. Now, you would think that diversity is what we're into in this country. But we have shown as fans that when we watch tennis, golf, anything else, you know, we love it when the Americans do well. 20 of the 33 starters at the Indy 500 were foreign born. The winner's foreign born. So we just don't like that.
What then is the answer for this sport? How do they fix what ails them?
You know, I think 2 or 3 years ago, they were in crisis. And they were saying, where do we go? How are we going to mount this thing back up? But now, you know, they've got a 5 rating, which isn't the worst rating in the world for, you know, I mean, Major League Soccer doesn't come anywhere close to that. And they feel like they're on their way to something. So, you know, I don't think the guys at Indy Racing are feeling like they're in a losing proposition. It only costs $4 to $5 million to run a contending car compared to NASCAR, $20 million a year. So there are young people coming up wanting to get in the sport. And as long as they have Danica, they're still smiling all the way to the bank.
All Danica, all the time. The Business of Sports with Diana Nyad. Thanks, Diana.
Thanks, Kai.
Book Expo America starts today. It's the largest annual book convention in this country. This year, it's here in Los Angeles, where publishers, literary agents, and retailers are all going to be trolling the floor looking for hits. There'll be some tension out there, too, because the book business is facing some real challenges, as Marketplace's Jill Barchet reports.
Lynette Park Sisler is a cookbook author. She didn't see her first royalty check until 8 months after her cookbook hit the bookstore shelves.
I was surprised that it took that long because I was so excited at the beginning of the contract. I went to bed. It was hard for me to sleep. I was thinking I was going to be rich the next day.
There's a reason Park Sisler had to wait so long. A book publisher ships thousands of books to bookstores, but it doesn't get paid for the merchandise right away. In fact, bookstores can wait 90 days or so to settle up. Park Sisler's publisher is Rudy Shore, who owns Square One Publishers outside of New York City. He started to notice a curious thing lately. Bookstores are returning books just before the 90 days are up and the bill is due.
And then a week or two later, they reorder the books. So they then have another 90 to 120 to 150 days to pay you. So from a publisher's standpoint, it's very frustrating.
Frustrating because it can be months before a publisher sees cash for the books he's shipped. Even if the publisher is lucky enough to get paid, it might have to give a big chunk of it back after 6 or 8 months. That's when bookstores return unsold books for good and expect a refund. In the case of Park Sisler's cookbook, Square One had to take back a quarter of the entire print run, 2,500 copies.
These are returns, two skids of returns that actually arrived here today.
That's Robert Love, Square One's business manager. He says bookstores are ordering tons of books, more than they can possibly sell. That's because the stores aren't really competing with each other. Instead, they're competing with the internet. They're afraid that if a customer can't find a title on a shelf, he'll go home and order the book online. So to keep the stores happy, publishers are saddled with the cost of printing too many books and having to take them back. Love says publishers have themselves to blame.
There was a limited amount of shelf space, so a publisher had to be willing to take back old books, backlist books that weren't selling, in order to get his frontlist books on the shelf and in front of the consumer.
Larger publishing houses are even more stretched. John Rose advises publishers at the Boston Consulting Group.
Most companies are looking at flat growth and a need to manage cost very effectively, which is changing in some ways the nature of the business.
For years, publishers have been cutting personnel. There are now fewer editors who've less time to nurture authors and improve manuscripts, and smaller marketing staffs who have to spend the bulk of their resources promoting the big bestsellers. That means the books that don't take off right away rarely come to the general public's attention. This is one reason why half of all new books fail. Rose says the biggest problem publishers face is from new electronic book readers that are starting to sell, like Amazon's Kindle.
The crazy thing about the book industry is that most of the people in the book industry think about books.
In other words, Rose says the threat to book publishing isn't about returns and refunds of printed paper. It's that new technology can bypass publishing companies altogether. Rose says publishers should think about a world where any writer can publish a book cheaply online, and any reader can download it freely. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, in which Wall Street says goodbye to one of its own. Bear Stearns effectively ceased to exist today. At a meeting in New York, 84% of the remaining Bear shareholders voted to sell the company to J.P. Morgan. The deal officially closes tomorrow. The offered price, you might remember, was $10 a share. That's up from the $2 J.P. Morgan offered as part of the Federal Reserve's deal to save the bank a couple of months ago. Investors who held on to the bitter end aren't even going to get that, though. Terms of the deal set Wednesday's close as the price, $9.32 a share to be specific. That is down from an all-time high of $171 just a year and a half ago. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Thursday. Today, the Dow gained 52 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ was up 21 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 jumped 7 points, 0.5% there. Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time, are you watching TV? Coke wants you. So does Pepsi and really almost everything out there.
If you are watching commercial television, you have just made a pact with the people who are delivering it that you are entering heavily commercialized space.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us.
Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.